This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today, it's our final episode about food insecurity and hunger in the Campfire Burn Scar. We'll be hearing from a researcher who studied food insecurity after multiple natural disasters and looking at what still needs to be done in our own backyard. Our food insecurity survey is still open, so if you are a campfire survivor and you have not taken it, we ask that you please take a look at it to help us further this reporting. You can find it at mynspr.org. If you have a thought or comment for us, you can leave it on our message line 433-9216. For Friday, July 3rd, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. In the first episode of this series, I told you that you would probably wonder how big of an issue food insecurity is in the Campfire Burn Scar. In a needs assessment survey that collected information on 1,268 campfire survivors done by the Campfire Collaborative in December of 2019 through February 2020, 52% of survivors listed food and gas as their top need. Data shared by the Megalia Community Church shows that as of June 2020, they were serving an average of 3,000 people per month. At the time of the church's last completed needs assessment, which took place about a year ago in August of 2019, the number one need of their shoppers was food. While I would love to share the numbers of our own survey, I can't because it's still open, so we can collect as many responses as possible. Because as you'll hear in this episode, the information is important. Dr. Lauren Clay is a disaster researcher and an assistant professor in the Health Services Administration Department at DeYouville College. I met her when she came to tour the Campfire Burn Scar earlier this year, as her focus is on disaster recovery. She studied long-term food insecurity after several natural disasters, so I recently reconnected with her to learn more about her work, first asking her about her research on long-term food insecurity after Hurricane Katrina.
So that study actually recruited families that had been displaced by Katrina. So they were either living in like FEMA trailer parks or other forms of congregate housing. And so they were recruited to be in a cohort study. So they were followed annually for 5 years. And then there was a follow-up done at 10 years at the 10-year anniversary. And so I had a chance to work with the data from that cohort of families that were heavily affected by Hurricane Katrina.
What were some of the things that you learned from that study?
Well, I initially had gone in to look, I was really interested in understanding community factors that influenced recovery outcomes. Recovery is the least well understood phase of a disaster. And I think that we often think from an emergency management or a disaster perspective that things happen much faster than they do. You see it with like the Stafford Act, which is the federal funding for disaster response. A lot of time that lasts for 1 year. And even if you talk with local officials, an emergency manager thinks, and rightly so, they're responsible for the response, right? They think that things are doing a lot better well before they actually are for families that have been heavily affected. So looking at the data from this cohort gave me an opportunity to really kind of understand what was going on in these families' lives and in their communities. So I actually went in to look at something completely unrelated to food insecurity, and food insecurity arose as a really important factor. We call it an ancillary finding, but it turned out to be one of the most interesting things that I learned from looking at the experiences of these families.
What were you originally going in to look at?
So I was pairing community data. So I was looking at community institutions, or those places where people come together in the community and interact and have a chance to build their networks, build social capital. And I wanted to know if different types of institutions were associated with different outcomes or the pace of recovery. And the initial approach that I took was a very statistical approach. And that approach has evolved over time to a more recent study looking at families that were affected by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. in Louisiana. So that work has been really interesting and is going somewhere. But when I was started to look at the experience of these families, food insecurity arose as such an important factor in their experience that I actually developed a whole new line of research focused just on that.
Can you talk about that more?
Prior to looking at food insecurity in the Hurricane Katrina cohort, there wasn't that much research done on food insecurity after disasters or how disasters like hurricanes or tornadoes or wildfires would disrupt the local food environment. So farmers growing food, moving that food through the infrastructure to get it to grocery stores or restaurants or to people's tables. So I've been looking at that now in Hurricane Florence in North Carolina, and I've also looked at it in Texas after Hurricane Harvey. And then recently now with COVID-19, I have several studies looking at the impact of the food environment by the virus and all of our behavior during the virus.
In your research, you know, with all of those, during COVID, obviously after these disasters, are there any, I guess I'd say themes, but anything that kind of comes out of all of them that you're seeing that's related?
I think for me, the most interesting theme that I've been exploring further is the relationship between food security and your social network. So we saw this in the Katrina cohort that high social support was associated with lower rates of food insecurity. In the Hurricane Florence study, we actually specifically asked people about who they were eating with and how they were getting their food and preparing their meals and how that was different than before the hurricane. And so one area that I'm really interested in studying more is the social supportive role of food after a disaster. So certainly we all need to eat. There's a nutritional component, but coming together to share food has so many other benefits. Coming together to share a meal where you also can talk about what you've been experiencing, you can share information, you can learn about resources, has greater benefits.
What else did you learn from that Katrina cohort study?
So we learned that at 5 years after Hurricane Katrina, in this cohort of families that were displaced, they were heavily affected by the storm, nearly a quarter of the respondents reported food insecurity. There were some factors that made people less likely to be food insecure, and they were very social factors. So having a partner, so being married or living with someone as though you were married, having a sense of community and having high social support were all factors that lowered your odds of being food insecure.
I don't know if you can speak to this, and you did a little bit earlier where you were talking about emergency response and sort of disaster aid, but I guess it's from your research. Is there anything you're seeing where there's a disconnect within our responses to disaster and food insecurity versus what's needed on the ground by survivors?
I think that we have a lot of opportunities to improve disaster response and recovery operations to better support families that are struggling. So an event happens, and what tends to happen is, you know, a disaster or an emergency is declared, and a lot of resources and people come to the area to provide support, and food is part of that. And then that slowly starts to go away. Things kind of go back to normal. But for families that were affected by the storm, there's a really broad range of what people are going through and a really different set of timelines, depending on how well off you were before and how, you know, well functioning your community was before, how much family and friends that you have to step up to support you. You know, if you have different levels of damage, there are so many factors. And so I do think that we have some federal programs and states and communities really step up in that response period. But then we have this longer term recovery. And I do think that we have an opportunity during these longer timescales to get really innovative to support families in new and different ways. One example that I would love to see as part of a long-term recovery initiative with, you know, funding from some sort of disaster funding mechanism is one where you are supporting either people who have restaurants or grocery stores or people who may have lost a job because their workplace was damaged and is not going to reopen to do some community feeding. So you're creating jobs. Maybe there's a restaurant. They have a lot of damage. They're doing everything they can to, you know, get the money together to rebuild. And then you could say, here, we'll give you this grant. You can get rebuilding and you can provide these community meals. So you're meeting a food need in the community and supporting a small business. It could also be people who lost a different type of job, but are interested in, you know, have a space to do some cooking. So there's some different ways you could go about doing it. But I do think that would be a really great sort of long-term recovery program that would give people a chance to keep coming together and to meet food needs.
So building community and then also helping out multiple people through that recovery.
Yes, I think that would be such a great way to support long-term recovery.
You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. When we're back, we'll hear more from Dr. Lauren Clay about her work researching food insecurity after a disaster. Stay tuned.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Learn more at raymondjames.com. And from iDrive, maker of Remote PC, providing access to computers anywhere for remote assistance and work from home, featuring Remote PC Meeting, a video conferencing tool. More at remotepc.com. Support for NPR comes from this station and from ProQuest, whose eNow programs help libraries support online studies by converting physical materials to digital, including books, journals, and music scores. ProQuest.com/go/NPR. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which aims to improve the quality of people's lives through grants supporting child well-being, the environment, medical research, and the performing arts. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. RWJF.org.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Today we're hearing the last episode in a 5-part series about food insecurity and hunger in the Camp Fire burn scar. Dr. Lauren Clay is a disaster researcher who has studied food insecurity after several natural disasters. Let's get back to our conversation.
I wanted to get back to research because you said that you started a new line of research, and I just am wondering how much research has been done on food insecurity after disasters.
Well, I would have said before January, not that much. So certainly people who study disaster preparedness would have included some sort of measure of food in that you typically would have some non-perishable foods in a disaster preparedness kit. So that was, I would say, the most common thing that you would see in research, food as an element of preparedness. There was also a little bit of research, and I'm talking mostly about research in the U.S. right now. There's also been a few articles that have been published, a few studies done looking at sort of crops and climate change and that sort of focus. There was also one study that was done looking at shrimp farmers after Hurricane Katrina, and then the food insecurity work that I've done with Katrina and Harvey and Florence, that would have been pretty much it for the U.S. Globally, food insecurity looks really different than in the U.S. due to different development contexts. So we don't have famine in the U.S., but when you look at complex humanitarian emergencies and disasters and how they intersect, you get things like famine. You have a lot of concerns about food security with sort of internally displaced people and conflict settings. So it has been heavily studied globally, but the context is really different in the U.S. So like I said, that's all before January. Since COVID-19 arrived in the U.S., there's a lot of focus on the disruption to our national food system and food security. So there are dozens of researchers, maybe hundreds of researchers, looking at food insecurity in the U.S. right now. But it's going to be a little bit different because COVID-19 is a novel virus. It's affecting the country, you know, fully, as opposed to a more localized event with a more natural environmental disruption. But it's still important work that needs to be done, and we will be able to learn things from the COVID-19 situation that will translate to other hazard settings.
I think that's really interesting because I've been reporting on the campfire really since, I mean, an hour after it started. And so I've seen a lot of change just as recovery has happened. And what month were you here again when you came to visit?
I was there in February. The first case was like identified 90 miles away or something while I was there.
Wow. I remember you coming and, you know, I think you took a tour of the burn scar. Did you go to Concow at all?
Yes.
So in that area at that time, there really wasn't much help in terms of organizations getting out to Concow. It's so rural. It's way out there. Really, the people who were there were people who were community members. And since the pandemic, there has been so much support for food access and food insecurity in that area. And I think that's just interesting because it, to me, it kind of mirrors a little bit with what's happening with that research where, because it's so big, this pandemic, now there's more focus on this area versus when it was the fire, it was the people who were really living the experience and some people, there were definitely people helping, but I see more resources now as well because of the pandemic.
Yeah. So in the, if you look in the hazards literature and especially in the like public administration and public policy literature that, you know, focuses on hazards, we often talk about focusing events. So there are things that you know are issues and you identify that that needs to be addressed. But then it takes another event to happen to really kind of push things through. And I think to some extent that could be happening. We've had several large scale events. We've had, you know, Harvey was major, Maria, Irma, Katrina, Florence, lots of hurricanes. And then the Camp Fire was certainly a large fire, but there were several others in recent years. And so we see this increasing disaster risk. And as a disaster and hazards research community and, you know, policy folks that are advocating for this, change is slow. And it's really hard, I think, especially with disasters, to get people to take action in the absence of a real threat. It's a lot of political capital to spend on something that might happen. And so this event with such widespread impacts might be just that thing that's going to like help push things forward in a meaningful way, or at least the optimist in me would like to think so.
Yeah. And especially as we will likely see more disasters in the future. That's one thing here. We've just seen, you know, fire after fire, they get bigger and bigger and more destructive.
I think a big concern now, too, is that we have a virus and also, you know, natural hazard threats are continuing. And so as, you know, the next fire or hurricane or tornado happens and people have to react, respond, take action, we have this additional threat. And so this compounding event, these the risks are so great right now.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, and again, I don't know if you can speak to this or not, but I've noticed with CalFresh, which is SNAP benefits federally, that you have this, we call it disaster CalFresh, but it's 30 days basically of disaster food benefits. And I'm wondering if you know at all what that research is based on and why that's the time frame.
So I haven't read anything in the sort of academic research community about it. So there's two things that happen. So there's disaster SNAP, DSNAP, or disaster CalFresh. And then there's also, we've seen with this event, something called pandemic EBT. So these are two programs that are relatively new. I mean, we're just starting to use these programs in, you know, the history of the country and disasters. And so there's a lot of discussion about evaluating the effectiveness of it right now. I lead the NOPRIN working group for COVID-19 and food insecurity subcommittee on surveys. As a working group, there are stakeholders that are working in advocacy and they're working on the ground and, you know, implementation of different policies and programs and for meeting food needs. And there's researchers. And it's something that we as a community of folks studying and working on meeting food needs in the community are talking about. There's actually a funding call out right now for proposals to look at the effectiveness of, you know, SNAP and WIC in this environment. So I think that research will be happening in the coming months and we'll know a lot more. I think it's, you know, just like with the pandemic, we're learning more about the virus every day and how it's transmitted and how to treat it and how it's moving through populations. We're also in real time trying to evaluate how effective what our response is to helping support communities getting through this.
One thing I was wondering, I asked our county here who disperses CalFresh if they were tracking fire survivors, and they said they were not. They did not ask that question, whether or not you're a fire survivor. So at this point, the only thing they can tell me is how many people have CalFresh benefits within a zip code. And I was just wondering why that metric isn't tracked, if you knew that, and then if that would be a valuable metric to start tracking since we are seeing so many disasters.
So as a disaster researcher, absolutely. It is an important thing to track. But to answer your question, each agency is deciding on their own what to track, and they each have different capacity and different interests to track different things. And so it's a little bit hard to answer for that agency. Generally, they'll have reporting requirements for different organizations, but, you know, they try to keep the burden to a bare minimum, and often they'll have different reporting requirements to different funders. And so it's very messy, and it's certainly, it's not as comprehensive as we would like. But, you know, for folks working on the ground, they're trying to balance the time that it takes to meet the needs, meeting their, you know, taking care of themselves and their own workers, the families that are coming to get assistance. Also, they're trying to balance their household needs and getting food. And it's really, you know, burden is a really big concern and an important thing to keep in balance. Although I would agree, it needs to be tracked. We need to have better and smarter ways to measure these things, because that is what's going to help us ensure that we're doing the most effective things, that we're efficient, and we're meeting as many needs as we can.
That was Dr. Lauren Clay, disaster researcher and assistant professor in the Health Services Administration Department at DeYouville College. As you just heard from Dr. Clay, we need to have better and smarter ways to track data to make sure we're meeting as many needs for survivors as we can. But after more than a year and a half after the fire, what are those needs? You've heard quite a bit about what still needs to be done and about solutions throughout this series, but we also posed those questions to pretty much everyone we've interviewed over the last 6 months. Here's what some of them had to say.
I would really like to see a farmer's market. We used to have one up here on Saturdays. I would love to see that happen again, a local farmer's market, especially for people who could grow on their property and share with the neighborhood or make a little extra money or whatever. That would be wonderful to be able to have more access to the fresh, good food.
I know the grocery stores, you know, they have so much food that they throw away. And it's such a shame to see so much good food go in the trash can. It'd be awesome if they could give it to the community or give it to an organization that could hand it out.
First of all, there needs to be more focus on a policy-wise and also community-wise investment in looking at this issue and starting the conversation about what's needed. The second one is supporting our local farmers and in whatever way we can, and that means by buying from them. And then the third thing is for us to grow more of our own food individually. And I would say those three things could completely change the face of local food here. And we're working on it.
I think if there was a stronger, if there was more communication of just notifying people what was available to help them. I don't know, sometimes it's just hard for some people to ask for help, and I think I'm one of them.
It's so important for us to reduce stigma. Let's talk about making great food so that we're moving beyond the poverty stigma, and we're going towards, you know, gourmet world.
One of the things that gives my team and I the energy to show up every day and continue to fight for food and meet those needs is the generosity of the people in the community. It's so powerful to see local farmers step up and provide fresh produce. People donate their time and their finances to making sure that needs met.
There's so many things that need to be done. Basic housing needs need to be met. Job creation. So folks that lost their job from the pandemic, you know, first from the burn scar and then now from the pandemic, have a way to create an income again, however that might be. Sometimes it's the same job, sometimes it's a different one.
Quality issues, quite frankly. So much of the food out in the food system is highly processed with negligible nutritional value.
So many people are still stuck in small apartments in town. You can't garden there. So their food bill went up. Everything went up. They didn't used to have power bill because they lived on solar. They didn't used to have a grocery bill because they raised animals and grew their own food. And so I just really feel we need more funding to offer more generators so they at least have a backup system for when the power's cut off. That helps keep their food fresh.
We had no emergency feeding plan in place. We didn't do it after the dam. We didn't do it after the fire. This needs to happen. But in order to come up with a feeding plan that's comprehensive for this region, or at least this county, we need some experts. Not only data, but we need folks who do that well, who do that for a living. Well, they don't do it for free, and so we need to identify some grant money or some other funding, because we feel an emergency feeding plan should be incorporated by the county and maybe the cities into their emergency plan. There's not much more basic than food. And for that not to be part of an emergency plan seems very short-sighted.
Is the need great? Yes. Are we going to continue to do stuff? Absolutely. But the amount of people that want to work for good is truly inspiring.
And that is your program. Before we go, I do want to say a few things. First, if you don't know, there has been a recent effort to help fix the digital information gap we've been hearing so much about. Two new bulletin boards created by members of the Campfire Collaborative were recently installed at the Dome Store in Concow and at the Save More in Magalia. Both are places to read about campfire and coronavirus resources and to post information. Also, if you're looking for information or resources and you have not heard of Butte Glen 211, try calling them or go to their website, which is helpcentral.org. They are this area's one-stop shop for information. Again, all you have to do is dial 211. This has been the final episode in a 5-part series on food insecurity and hunger in the Campfire Burn Scar. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call on our message line 433-9216. The series was produced by Christian Solis and Sarah Bohannon as part of a project for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism Impact Fund. Thanks to Eric Rodeville and Kylo Castilla for additional editing support. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following weekday morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to North State Public Radio.